This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Recently, I had the pleasure of attending a poetry salon in a private home in Santa Rosa for the poet Gregory W. Randall. He is the author of an award-winning chapbook by the name of Double Happiness. It won the 5th Annual Camber Press Chapbook Award Contest, which was judged by Mark Doty. He has other chapbooks out in the world, including Blue Water Views, Uncommon Refrains, and he has poems in A Room in the Country, which was published by Pudding House Press. I'm just going to move right on to the poetry reading right now. The introduction is given by another Santa Rosa poet and playwright, David Beckman. Here we go.
So welcome all to our home, and a particular welcome, of course, to Greg and Tony, and to all of you. It's a real pleasure to have you here to celebrate the arrival of Double Happiness, Greg's new chapbook. For me, one of the abiding pleasures of being a poet in Sonoma County is having Greg as a friend and colleague. Over the years, I've gotten to know both Greg and his work pretty well, and one of the pleasures for me is finding the journey in any one of his poems, and there inevitably is one, and I find that the journey is often toward intellect, feeling, and craft. And it occurs to me that's probably what most of us were looking for when we first started writing. So we look and Greg finds. And we just have to live with that. For me and everyone, I think, probably, Greg's poem is musical in the extreme, literate, I want to say, not hyper-literate by any chance, but definitely literate. Not literary. That's what I was fishing for. I won't say literary. And deeply felt. And I particularly like the musicality of his poetry and the wordplay, which kind of glimmers on the surface. And the only thing I like better is the wordplay and the musicality that lingers in the depths. And I think we're all going to enjoy hearing that. So the book is Double Happiness. And the book won the annual Camber Press Chapbook Award, the 5th annual. And it was judged by Mark Doty. And Mark Doty himself has a nice quote that I'll share. Gregory W. Randall's elegant chapbook chronicles the history of a pair of lovers, perhaps a singular couple, though the poet also seems to invite us to read them as representative citizen of Cupid's realm, as enthralled and hapless as we all are, and carried forward through a life by the strange, potent power of love and connection. And I think the other thing to say is that Greg builds his poetry to a large extent around musical forms, particularly Schubert and Schumann song cycles, which we've been playing here. So I think that's enough for me, and I would now like to welcome Greg Randall, who will read from his new book.
Thank you, David. So Catherine asked me if I was nervous, but I told her I've got two things in my favor. One is you're all dear friends. Number two, I'm just imagining you all naked right now. So first of all, I really want to extend a deep appreciation and thank you to David and Sharon for opening up the house. When David heard the book was coming out, he immediately offered to host a book launch. It was very kind of you both to open this up. So, and thank you all for actually coming out today. It's really been a pleasure. So some people give birth after 9 months. This book took 9 years to give birth to. And it was originally written, most of the book was actually, well, I'll share a little bit about it. There's some prose poems in the book that were written in the fall of 2007. Most of the poems were written actually over the course of 4 days in the summer of 2008 when Tony and I were vacationing on the Humboldt Coast. That's a little bit of a misnomer because as most people in the room who are poets know, most poems don't just show up. They've been sitting around in pieces and parts forever, but something clicks and you finally figure out how to bring them together and actually shape them into poems. And that's how the chapbook came up. about. And I did do a workshop, which some in this room were attended, with David St. John, where I workshopped this book. I think Joe and Christina were there, and Susan and Lynn. And they encouraged me to send it off. So I sent it off to Canberra Press, where Mark Doty was judging. And it won the prize, and I got the prize money, which is nice. And I got the proofs, and I emailed back the proofs, and I never heard again from the editor. So he was completely non-responsive. He was all over Facebook promoting his own book on the East Coast, but he never, the press collapsed. So the book just kind of languished, and I finally decided to contact Conflux Press to put the book in place. So the book, as David alluded to, I am sort of a classical music fiend, and the book was actually structured along kind of a classical song cycle, oftentimes produced by Schubert or Schumann, in which you have various songs that actually tell an evolving story as it goes along. And so I thought what I would do is read sequentially a selection of the poems that gives you kind of a sense of the story, which is essentially of two lovers and their relationship that develops over time. But the book was also designed to be kind of pseudo-fabulistic, pseudo-mythic. So you're going to see a lot of sort of Ovidian metamorphosis going on in the book as well. And you may or may not be interested to know the book is, there is no sections, but it starts off with, there are 18 poems. I have to remember this, it's been 9 years. There are 18 poems. There's first six are stanzaically structured. Then there's a section of six prose poems, which are the only prose poems for whatever reason I've ever written. And then it finishes up with six more stanzaic. I will say that working with Conflux, one of the benefits of working with the press, where you're basically self-publishing, is you get to be a lot involved with the production of the book. So I got to choose the artwork. We worked on the French flaps. And to give you kind of an example, this is the difference between a book that where you get to be intimately involved with it and a book where you're not involved at all in the production of the book itself. So the painting is actually a painting by an artist named Arthur Matthews, which is not even hanging anywhere. It's actually, it's called The Wave. And it's hard to see, but when you get up close, it's actually the back shoulders of a woman as the wave is collapsing over her. And down below her is this dark torso of a man who's kind of wrenched over as the wave is passing them. And they're blending into the water themselves. And I saw this, oh gosh, about 15 years ago on a poster at the Oakland Museum of California, and I fell in love with it. And the Oakland Museum of California has a huge collection of Arthur Matthews paintings. He was a painter in the late 1800s, early 1900s in California. And what's kind of sad is Oakland Museum of California didn't charge us anything to use this artwork, because for decades they have not been able to find a single heir to the estate of Arthur Matthews. There's all these orphaned paintings that are sitting around in crates that nobody has any claim to. So I'll begin with the first poem. The first poem is entitled Boy and Girl in a Field. I dislike certain flowers, she said. Zinnias in particular. And dahlias, and most things brash and orange. Sometime later, crossing the meadow, he realized none of these flowers could represent her. She was a patch of unassuming pale blue and cream-colored wildflowers, the sort so numerous and understated they're mostly overlooked. And he was gripped by an urge to study them closely, to pronounce their Latin names, as well as their common ones. And still, he was no closer to an understanding of asters. The slightest smudge renders a butterfly flightless, she said. And so he halted while nearing a mock monarch who'd paused on wild fennel. From a distance, and without the aid of a net, he'd surmise its erratic patterns of flight. Clouds beg to be named, she said, after which he could never flatten grass and stare at a cloudscape without seeing a seahorse or a dungeness crab or squid tentacles all evaporating into flaxen hair. And because clouds never repeat themselves, these were the last sea creatures of their kind to form below an azure sky. The next two poems I'm just going to read together. The first one's called Lovers in a Moon Garden. And are anybody familiar with what a moon garden is? This idea came about when Tony and I went on a field trip to the botanical gardens at UC Davis and learned about a moon garden. And then we came home and realized that the man who had
planted our front yard, had planted a moon garden anyway. We had all these bright plants that shone in the bright moonlight. And that's where this poem comes from. Lovers in a Moon Garden. Indoors had become intolerable. Unbearable heat. Air unswirling. Feet leaving moist prints on the hardwood. And so, like aristocrats from ancient India, they entered the moon garden. White roses on elongated stems, chalky lavenders, tufts of pale grass all lit up with moonlight. A personal cosmos winding across the enclosed yard. Almost how they could extend their sense of the flowering season. Bruised petals, roses beginning to wither, all masked in shadows, and the not quite clear images night and its half moon evoke. They had cultivated white flowers for this purpose, fragrant ones to attract moths, especially a sphinx, which might flash its kaleidoscope of dusty wings in a porch light, or the glow from a casement window, almost perfecting this dark stroll in heavy air through fragrant shards of moon, remembered afterward as some brief, capricious moment of their life. White flowers, scuffling moths, the half-moons her eyes would make in laughter. Scene with swimmers. Summer swims last for hours, even when at first the waters crash around their waists, as bodies, sun-baked, collide with the stream's cold currents. Soon enough, their blood thickens and acclimates as they plumb beneath a surface buoyant with pine husks. Their suitless bodies a smudge of umber, color of tired earth, of dusk, of smoldering grapevines, while they dive below for longer stretches, practicing for caudal fins and pectorals in case, one day soon, they're granted their desire to become fish, to inhale and exhale water, to glimpse fir trees from below, distorted as in a circus mirror. Then, later, with skins suddenly scaled and rubied, to win their way down creeks and tributaries to an ocean vast and emptied of gravity. This next poem is going to be the section of the prose poems, which are intended to kind of get more mythological in their transformations. And this is the title poem, Double Happiness, which actually comes... This is the title poem, Double Happiness, which comes from the Chinese symbol for marriage. She desired above all to convert her arms into talons, her ruinous legs into expansive wings and soar at cloud level. After she spoke, he retold a recurrent dream in boyhood in which he'd levitate just long enough to hurdle telephone wires that sagged across the street. His desire, above all, was to inhabit the interior of books, where his dull speech might span the emotional gap between noise and sound, glance and glare, pain and agony. After which she explained how pain mangles a body physically, whereas agony obliterates desire. Later, neighbors spotted them ambling down a road over cracked pavement toward a cul-de-sac. They heard him reading aloud from a book composed entirely of transitive verbs, while she threaded telephone wires and scattered pale doves in a moment of pure solitude, pure flight. This next one is entitled Suburban Pastoral. They desired immutability, and to that end became statuary in the backyard. Molded in concrete, they would never age nor ambulate in pain, but simply grow rough and gray and flecked with lichen. Occasionally, and without consternation, a few fissures would appear where springtime moss asserts its luster. Tucked beneath a fragrant shade of lilacs, or a side of fern slowly unwinding its fronds, They greet the return of robins scavenging the yard. The migration of homeowners, the arrival of death caps never faze them. They remain forever a girl extracting a sticker from her foot, a boy leaning forward inspecting a toad. Together in balmy air, they welcome the reddening of strawberries and dream of figs. This next prose poem is entitled Epiphany, and there was a request to have it read. Her acupuncturist told her she'd evolved from dolphins. This made sense. For her, water had become nourishment, the only space through which she moved freely and without pain. She could envision herself without legs, without arms, without long stretches of uneven pavement to traverse. She could see her body sleek and swift, leaping from waves, containing the shapes of a sickle or waxing and waning moons. She could feel herself skimming the surf, revealed in a jade window moments before sea froth collapsed around her. Dolphins were once thought to transport souls from the physical world to a realm of nebulous shades. And so he feared for years spending weeks at the seashore, where she'd meander wet sands at low tide, where she'd ingest ocean smells and the sonorous assembling and dismantling of waves. At any moment, he realized she might plunge into cobalt waters and return to her kind. I'm going to read three more poems from this book. The last section of the book are six stanzaic poems where the couple has decidedly grown older, and they've actually moved into kind of a retirement apartment. And you begin to understand that she's taken ill. And this poem is called is Nocturne, and it's more from her perspective than his, as we'll obviously see. Nocturne. Even at this late hour, she goes back. Beyond the window screen where papery iris tap. Beyond the scamper of coyotes and the bare moon etching the outlines of torpid sage, of warm rocks. Back to those fortunate days when heavy air pressed against their skin, when mosquitoes prowled the shadows even in daylight and left welts on their thighs and shins. Days they felt every square inch of their legs as they carved desire paths through a field and with their bodies shaped molds in the grass. Everything becomes more distinct when the sun drops behind a row of elms. Scales on an oak's trunk, the veins in a leaf, the lines on her hands. It's evening in a field engulfed by fireflies, where moonlight splits the clouds that shift with the motion of languid fish. Around her, the scrape of crickets, then a man's voice, groping its way toward the hard vowels of love. So every song cycle and every sort of musical needs its dream sequence. So this poem is dream sequence. First, the Scotch pine fell in a storm and split the roof and severed the bedroom in half. He climbed its slick trunk and looked in a downpour for phone bills scattered about. Afterward, he was at the retirement home. Everyone was shuffling over the lawn, over a great expanse of crabgrass and impatience, toward the lagoon's edge where a spotted minnow swam. They said everyone must leave. The building's old, outdated, to be torn down. And so they all loaded onto a ferry which skirted a row of jagged rocks through a narrow gorge opening to a sea. In this late afternoon sun, invisible and without contours. He thought, how could the hole have possibly missed those rocks? It didn't matter. He was a passenger on an Airbus bound for Seattle, a plane that came in so low he could see the texture on the bill of a pelican, even its slight shadow against the erratic green waves. The jet teetered just above the bay on the force of wind. Apparently, the engines failed. When at last he told himself to wake, He knew she would not come home. And this is the final poem in the book, the last poem. It's entitled The Ascension, a fable. He was accustomed to buying groceries for one person. And so he'd stopped at Costco to stock the fridge and pantry of his neighbor on the floor above. An old man now, he spoke exclusively in the past tense and refused to promise any see-you-laters. One night, a torrent of rain and wind and lightning splintered the pine trees and uprooted the oaks, crushing roofs in the neighborhood. By midnight, the levees burst, and floodwaters engulfed the apartment complex, rising to cover the bottom floors. He awoke in bed to the smell of lake water and mildew, astonished to find beside him his late wife sprawled out and naked, hair spread out like seagrass, who inhaled swamp water through gills, perfectly relaxed in their aquarium of an apartment. "Is this heaven?" he asked, as his neck burned and tore and split, making a space for gills. So I'm going to, in the time we have left, I thought I would read. So it's a strange reality, as you know, with books, especially books that are 9 years old. You've been living with these poems for so long. And as Catherine was saying to me earlier today, they're new for you, and they're new for us, but old for you. But I did think I thought I would share some relatively newer things that I've been working on. I have a full-length book that's I'm looking to bring out conflicts actually beginning of next year. And one of the poems from that book is what I thought I would share with you today, and it's entitled Every Moment the Mind Maneuvers. Every moment the mind maneuvers toward its next moment. So each moment becomes an elegy, and the past a grime fresco beyond repair. There was a life before this one, and some days I can almost return to it. But our old selves have long since been cast in clay behind plexiglass. And even when I harvest lilacs, or when the unmistakable fragrance of jasmine wafts across the yard, I am again remembering you, but never as then. Looking back, it's like a separate life, where two figures who hardly resemble us, as if carved into a limestone frieze, still gleam the dark, flat seeds of wisteria to propagate vines and harness in the scent of those pendulous blooms a deep and abiding history. The events of this life pile up like casualties. The present moment greets us slick and evasive as a betrayal. What's left but to burn this instant into the brain, the way your skin's flecked like a stone fused out of smashed minerals, and your proprietary intake of breath. The Greeks painted their statues to give life to marble, to make the gods in their own image. They are now, all of them, leached and worn replicas, cracked torsos veined with cinders, will never again mistake for breathing. So for the last couple of years, I've been working on long poems, and I've been tormenting my writing group with them about every month. I'm sure at some point they're going to say, okay, it's time to embrace haiku. But the long poems, many of them have been using this title Fantasia as something. And part of that title, David kind of reminded me of a term Fantasia because he started using that for a couple of poems a while back. And I remember studying Fantasias in college when I was studying music. And so I wanted to use the term Fantasia because the poems themselves, how many are you familiar with sonata form, classical music sonata form? Okay, most of you. So in general, in sonata form, you have four sections. You have the opening exposition, in which the composer states two themes. And then you have this development section where he mixes and matches, or she mixes and matches, and tries out these different themes. And then you have a recapitulation, which they come back into a transformed state. And then there's the coda. And I always think of it as like kind of test driving cars. The development sections is test driving of cars and taking them out everywhere. In Mozart and Haydn's day, in particular, that development section was usually referred to as the Fantasia or the Fantasia, because it was the place where It was just a free-formed exploration of ideas from these themes. And so these Fantasia poems were kind of based a little bit off of a lot of studying I did of Larry Lepus, who has written these gorgeously long poems where he takes three ideas and he braids them throughout. And so each of the Fantasias was trying to take two or three ideas and become that development section, just kind of rearrange them and play with them as different ways and see if they could be transformed at the end. So this is the current big project that the writing group has been taking Advil each time I bring them to the writing group. And I thought it would be, actually Tony thought it would be generous if I handed out a copy as I read through it. Mm-hmm. Especially since you're going to see at the beginning these italics. And these italics come from a very short poem by Czesław Miłosz called Encounter. And I don't know why, I just got taken by these lines and just started playing with them, and this is what came out. So this is entitled Fantasia is the Sound of Pebbles Scattering.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Gregory Randall.
Where are they going? The red wing and the hare and the rustle of pebbles. Miłosz was asking not out of sorrow, but in wonder. I'm asking out of sorrow and in wonder, for I am full of doubt and want everything. Magnolias converting white spearheads into unfurled spinnakers tacking over green, glassy bays. Before their petals in the span of a few days curl and brown into scorched papyrus sheaves. And figs, which swell and darken and split overripe crevices, where wasps poke needle-like tongues to lick the sticky juice in a final, desperate feast. Before cold dawns frost their wings into stillness. Is it still summer? Yes, it is still summer. The fields have not frozen. The red wings and hares have not perished. The Christmas cantatas have not yet begun to reassure us with their well-worn story. Look at the stones along the deck railing and on the ground in spherian calendulas in their dry, baked soil. So many stones lugged up from coves, which the sea and sand mortared with pits and holes, where clams settled and starved, where their ridged shells now clatter when shook. Yes, but where are they going, the stones? Toward a rustle of pebbles. Don't ask in sorrow, but in wonder, for here in Miłosz's lines is what becomes of those granulated stones so desired. Salt. And corrosive waves, and the collision with other stones, and the unfathomable lifespan of seas, reducing them to particles, and the sound of those particles scattering. Now would be the time for one of Vivaldi's intense lyrical tunes. A violin mocking a castrato's compressed lungs as it paces the requisite steps of ritornello form. Where are they going, those secular violins? Exactly where you'd expect. Listen to the crunch of gravel kicked at the feet of those young people hoisting a telescope over the drive. Where are they going? To glimpse storm clouds on Jupiter? To see a nebula forming in the blade of Orion's sword? To contemplate the dark enigma ensphering them? Now would be the time to consider Lu Qi, a 3rd-century soldier poet, who fled when his empire collapsed, who knew that to take writing brush in hand was to embrace failure and death. Still, he longed to enter the mystery and stood at the center of the universe contemplating the enigma, then scrawled into flawless skies, opening above a gorge turreted with pines, his own calligraphy. You say this moment is unique among all the moments. A moment in which we are forever sowing and threshing all that is meaningful. This moment, which renews itself as this moment, and points itself towards eternity. But I am full of doubt, and want everything. The flight of a gold finch as it rides out of the arms of a redwood tree on swells of air. Can you not enter its sky? Can you not, too, press out of an engorged throat a liquid song? What's more astonishing? That Bach drops the halo sound of violins accompanying Jesus' recitatives when he cries out from the cross? Or that the whole time Jesus trod the earth, Bach gave his speech a corona of shimmering strings? I ask out of sorrow and in wonder, and feel a sudden need to invert Lucci's lines. We honor the splotched leaves torn away by autumn, and mourn the fragile cracks of buds in spring. Yes, I hear the rustle of pebbles. They sound like ghosts, and the memory of red wings vanishing in falling snow, and the after hum of strings. Where are they going, those young people lugging a telescope out into the street, to view up close outlines of mythic figures shuddering in the sky? Did they not see at their feet this whole time specks of mica flickering over the darkness and the shapes of galaxies pulling farther apart?
Wow. Beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for coming. And being a part of it. Thank you. Thank you for passing it out.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Ward Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard Santa Rosa poet Gregory W. Randall reading from his collection of poems, Double Happiness, and a new poem as well. If you're interested in purchasing his book, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com, and I'll get you in touch with Gregory. But right now we have another guest here, and it is local Santa Rosa playwright David Beckman. He is also a poet and a novelist, but he's here today to tell us about a new play of his called The Plot Against Shakespeare. It will be staged this August at Shakespeare in the Cannery in Santa Rosa. David, welcome to Word Temple.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
This is not your first play. I saw your play Becoming Walt Whitman when it was produced at the 6th Street Playhouse in Santa Rosa.
That's right.
And that went over very, very well. I think you won some kind of award at that point as being a favorite.
That was actually maybe a year or two later, mm-hmm. the Short Play Festival.
Okay.
Which in this case happened in 2014, and I had a short play in that, and indeed mm-hmm. shared honors of favorite play with the audience.
Well, I think Becoming Walt Whitman deserves it, too.
Oh, thank you.
It was a great, great play.
Thank you.
So your short plays have, you know, been produced in New York, Santa Cruz, Dallas, the 6th Street Playhouse, Monterio, and you've also taught some play workshops, short play workshops in Santa Rosa. Are you still doing that, or is that something you don't have time for anymore?
More or less don't have time for. Actually, two or three of those, at least, were out at Pegasus Theater in Monterio.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I've done one recently in Santa Rosa. They're a lot of fun. People are very avid to learn how to write 10-minute plays.
Yeah.
And it's less of an undertaking than a full-length play. So, yeah, they're a lot of fun to teach.
I bet they are. Well, you studied playwriting in New York's Circle in the Square Theater, a place I have enjoyed myself. And as an actor, you toured with a National Shakespeare Company. So your experience goes way back.
It does. And that was way back.
We won't say how far back. We don't want to date ourselves.
But you're right. Yeah.
Well, I'm really looking forward to The Plot Against Shakespeare. Before we talk about the play, why don't you tell me a little bit about where it's going to be? Because this is a pretty new endeavor in Santa Rosa.
It is. It is. The production company and the acting company is called Shakespeare in the Cannery. And if you can picture Old Railroad Square, just like west of it across the tracks, there are a couple of old standing walls that have been there 100 years, brick walls that were part of the Del Monte Cannery. And inside where those walls stand had been kind of a nondescript area for many years. 3 years ago, a group of people got together, cleared the whole thing out, built a set, rounded up actors, and the first year produced Romeo and Juliet outside under the stars. It was a tremendous success. It was a beautiful production. I happened to see it.
Well, who were the people involved in this?
Yeah. Chris Costin, a local lawyer, entrepreneur. David Lear, very fitting name for a Shakespearean.
Yeah.
Has lots of directing, set building, theater experience via Sixth Street Playhouse and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of the brains behind it with a couple other people, and they put it together. And, I also have to tribute the Arlene Francis Center and Martin Hamilton, who has been very key as being a producing partner with David Lear and Chris Costin. So in any event, they had this wonderful success with Romeo and Juliet. It was beautifully done. The next year, which had been last year, they produced Twelfth Night, also a sterling performance, I think 8 or 10 shows during the course of August. And that brings us to this year.
Mm-hmm.
When David approached me, actually during the intermission of Romeo and Juliet 2 years ago, to say that they're looking to do something new and different. They were going to produce Macbeth this year, but they would hope to add a second play. And would I write it?
Fantastic. So
now,
you didn't have a play ready.
I did
you
not.
Were asked to write one.
I did not.
That's unusual.
Yeah.
And
so David had a couple of ideas, and I said, let me go away and think about this and see what I think I might want to do. So I came back with the concept for this play, The Plot Against Shakespeare.
Well, where do we start with this story? First, how did you come up with the idea for this particular play? You had to come up with something. So I did. Did you find it?
Yeah, maybe it found me. But in any event, this first little talk with the intermission of Romeo and Juliet, David Lear said to me, what would you think about combining a couple of Shakespeare's plays? I mean, it's something completely out of the box. What if we tried to combine Hamlet and Macbeth? And, you know, I thought about it. Yeah, I said, wow, that would be heavy duty. I'm not sure. It may be apples and oranges. He said, well, along those lines, something really out there. See what you can come up with. So I thought about it for a week and came up with this concept, The Plot Against Shakespeare, in which Shakespeare's the main character. It's set in 1611 when he's 47. And he has writer's block.
Oh, dear.
Complete and thorough. Now, this is my invention. We don't know if he ever had writer's block. He probably did at some point. In any event, so he's in a heap of trouble with his company, the King's Men, because they rely on him to write play after play after play. He's in trouble with himself. He just has no idea where to turn. And so the play becomes about this, and his company comes to him and
says, Let me interrupt you a second. I mean, just because he has writer's block. Is this how you felt yourself when you sat down, having been given an assignment to write a play? Did you sense a little writer's block in the beginning?
And no.
Thus it went into the play? No.
No,
okay.
I didn't.
Shakespeare was alone with this melody.
Yeah.
Okay, go on.
I knew I needed a device. I needed to put him in a state of upsetment, if not crisis, because the main character in a play has to have a dramatic challenge. Well, what could that be? It just occurred to me this could really be fun. So his acting company appears to him and says, you've got to get over this in a hurry. We need 3 more plays from you this year. And then there's next year. And he's just tearing his hair out. And then it occurred to me, maybe one night at 3 in the morning, his own characters come to him. So Macbeth and Lady Macbeth and Henry V and Hamlet and Oberon and Puck and Shylock, they all have a meeting.
So this is a mirror. Instead of him telling his characters what they're going to do, he's going to tell them what to do.
Exactly.
Ugh,
and they use his own language that they've given him in his plays to put a lot of pressure on him to get over whatever it is he's going through. Because what they say is, look, if you stop writing, you could easily go into oblivion, and then so will we.
Right. What will happen to them?
Us, yes. We need to be produced over and over for years to come. So
That's great.
Of the play becomes them trying to persuade him. And then, of course, Lady Macbeth, being Lady Macbeth, comes up with a whole other solution.
Which is?
Dare I give it away? Of course I do. She says to Macbeth, no. We kill him.
We kill Shakespeare?
Yes.
Oh, God. That is Lady Macbeth all the way.
And Macbeth goes, we do what? She goes, we kill him. That's what we do. We run him through. We throw him in the river. And we come up with somebody else that we'll say wrote all his plays anyway.
Oh my gosh. And there's the controversy. Who wrote Shakespeare's play?
There is. So my play deals with that. They come up with a stand-in. I won't give away who that is. It's one of the people that's suspected of writing Shakespeare's plays. And the fact is he can't write a lick.
So it's not Christopher Marlowe.
No, it's not. It is not Christopher Marlowe. I would not do that to Christopher Marlowe. This is somebody else. And they try to put this plot together. They're going to kill Shakespeare. They'll promote this guy. He wrote all of Shakespeare's plays anyway. Blah, blah. Well, of course, it doesn't work because it is a comedy. And we know Shakespeare wasn't murdered mid-career. So
this is fantastic. Well, I hope that you brought a scene or two or three with you.
One.
You brought one with you.
I did.
And why don't you tell us about this scene?
Okay.
And then go ahead and read it to us if you'd like.
I will. This is one of the last things I wrote. And it's a monologue for Shakespeare.
Okay.
And my thinking was I've got to keep him front and center. And there's so many other fascinating characters. But I got to keep Shakespeare driving the plot, being, you know, the main character in the play. And he starts out with writer's block. Hopefully he can get over it. Through the course of the play, finds out he can't. He's confronted by his acting company, his other character. He gets more and more desperate. And finally, this is late in Act Two, toward the end of the play. He's got insomnia. He has not been able to solve writer's block. He just is at his wit's end, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. So this monologue that I gave him comes at that moment.
All right.
So Shakespeare's alone on stage. He's angry, and he's pacing. Renegade sleep, where are you? He looks under his table in a corner. Are you here? Here? Your absence has turned my muse into a donkey. A barn dog, a squawking, leprous, foul-tongued, he breaks his quill. Writes, of course, with quills. A plague on quills, he tears up paper. A curse on paper, he stamps on them both. There and there and there, oh, aren't I brave, who has advanced not at all this whole month and more. Nature, you are impotent. Mind, a pit of food left for beggars. He takes out a vial with liquid in it. Well, here's an end to howling at the moon, one I've bought of an apothecary on Lower Thames Street. Drink one quarter of it, he said, and feel a pleasant and drowsy calm. Curses on your drowsy calm, I bleated. Patience, he said. Drink half the vial, and you will sleep fathoms deep and long. I grabbed it and paid him. But no caution, said he. Drink a sip more than half, and fiendish whips and spurs will come about your brain that ne'er depart. Drink it all, and make death thy bedmate, who, laughing, will crawl akimbo with thee to the dreaded well of nothingness. That man had a way with words. So here stand I, holding life's succor or its end. Elixir, I now drink half of you. He drinks. Sleep comes swift, or I swear I'll next upend the glass and drain it dry.
Oh my goodness, what a moment in the play. We don't want Shakespeare dying.
No,
we don't. Oh my goodness. Who are some of the people who will be acting this play?
Yes, we have wonderful actors. David Lear has put together an entire acting company that's been with him through the first two plays and now this one. I have a wonderful actor, Kevin Laughlin, who's playing Shakespeare. And he's a very experienced Shakespearean actor. The young couple who played Romeo and Juliet, Carmen and Hot, have major roles in this play. Hot is playing Hamlet, and I found a way to incorporate some of Hamlet's soliloquies. For example, Henry V, who's put together this group of characters to put pressure on Shakespeare, finds Hamlet to be quite reticent, naturally, because that's what Hamlet is. He won't join in. He won't commit to saving. And Henry keeps meeting with him and saying, what is the matter with you? Well, my lord, I don't know. I need to think some more. And Henry goes, think, that's all you do is think. He said, you must go to Hamlet, and I want you to practice now, and then go to Hamlet and tell him what he needs to know. You know, the guy's at his wit's end. And so Henry leaves the stage, and Hamlet goes, ah, I think I've got it. I will say, to be or not to be? That is the question.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
He goes through his entire monologue.
Uh-huh. That's great. And other people, other actors in the
Yeah,
play?
I didn't bring my cast list with me. Okay. I'm getting to know people. I'm a little embarrassed. I don't know everybody's name. But we have some wonderful performers. We have the three witches.
Mm-hmm.
We've got, of course, Lady Macbeth, Beatrice, Viola, a lot of the heroines from his plays.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I really have a wonderful group of actors.
So it is a comedy indeed, but clearly with some very dramatic moments
yes.
in it. So it's going to be a good roller coaster ride emotionally,
hope.
I think.
I hope.
So tell me where, well, we know it's going to be at the Cannery. You described
right.
where that is.
Right.
When is it going to be
yes.
performed?
Yes, I'll tell you when it's going to be and then the best way to get tickets and find out more.
Okay.
First, let me give the website mm-hmm. is ShakespeareInTheCannery.com.
Okay.
ShakespeareInTheCannery, all one word, .com. Go there, you'll see a video about the plays, and then click on tickets, and
good.
Easy way to get tickets. It opens at the venue on August 12th, which is opening night. That's a Friday, and then it'll be that following Saturday, and then for the next 3 weeks, every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, up until the end of August.
That's a wonderful run.
Yeah.
You're going to have a lot of people showing up for
I hope
this.
So.
Yeah.
I hope so.
And for those of you who use Facebook, you can also go to facebook.com/ShakespeareInTheCannery and see some information there.
Right.
According to this little card. There's going to be free parking at all of the performances in the TVAX parking lots in front of their store off Wilson Street and behind the store off of 6th Street.
Right.
And you can also park in the city public parking lot in Railroad Square, which is that little lot under 101 between 4th and 5th Streets. And, well, I wish you a whole lot of
Thank
luck
you.
For this play. I'm going to try to remember to announce it in my July program as well, because I have been to your plays. I've been, you know, really thrilled with them, and I'm really looking forward
Great.
To this one a whole lot.
Thank you. And I should add
mm-hmm.
that Macbeth is the first play. That will go up in July.
Oh, okay. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's going to be a wonderful, innovative production of Macbeth. Same venue.
Mm-hmm.
So July, come to the Cannery and see Macbeth. And then August, The Plot Against Shakespeare. And it's all on the website.
Okay, which again is ShakespeareInTheCannery.com.
Right.
Okay. Well, you would think I would let you go at this point, but I'm not going to, because there's one other work of yours that I'd like to mention. Okay. Summer's coming up, and you have a novel out there called Under Pegasus. Is this still available? If people would like a copy, can they
Best come to
you?
Me. It hasn't been in the bookstores in a while.
Well, that's okay.
But yes,
you
there are copies available.
Good, because I read this book, I think it was in 2011 when you gave this novel to me, and I enjoyed it so much, and I'm looking for summer reads, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to read this one again, and I'd like to tell people about it because I really enjoyed it. This is a book called Under Pegasus, and the book cover says, on the day after Jack Transit, 45, achieves his flashiest coup as an advertising executive, he is stunned by a chance encounter with Emily, his ex-wife, once a brilliant musician, now a ragged and hallucinating homeless person dwelling deep in the bowels of New York City's Grand Central Station. His confusion grows when he meets their 20-year-old daughter, Minerva, a rock guitarist whom Jack never knew existed. So this is a great read, David. And let me just ask you, I know this is a surprise, I'm pulling a fast one on you here, but where did the idea for this novel come about?
Yes.
Can you reach back that far?
I can. I'm so glad you brought it up. I have such strong feelings about this book. It's my only published novel. Yes, so Grand Central Terminal was, back in the 80s, was a home for a lot of homeless people. And my wife and I worked in the advertising business, and we used to commute through the terminal, as did thousands of people. So here we are in our suits and with our briefcases, and there's homeless people, they're musicians, and there's street people. And it was one of these yin and yang things. And I kept asking myself, how can there be two tribes here, us and them, that's we're all human beings? And what would it take for a connection to happen between someone like myself going off to a Madison Avenue office mm-hmm. and someone like that? And it just really ate on me. And I finally just came up with this idea that a man is walking through Grand Central and he sees someone he knew, not only knew, but was married to many years before. And of course, then that connection has to happen. There has to be an encounter. Mm-hmm. And it really took off from there. And I gave Emily is the homeless musician. And I said no, and they've got to have a child together that he never knew about.
Oh, yeah.
And that'll really make the connection have to happen. So that was the beginning.
Well, it's a wonderful novel, really an enjoyable read.
Thank you.
So again, that's Under Pegasus. And if anyone out there is interested in it, you can contact me and I'll put you in touch with David Beckman. How is that? Okay. Well, David, thank you so much for coming today. And again, we look forward to Shakespeare in the Cannery. And I'm going to just remind people one more time that Macbeth will be performed there from July 1st to July 23rd. And then from August 12th through August 27th, The Plot Against Shakespeare. All right. Well, we'll see you at the Cannery.
Thank you, Catherine. It's been a pleasure.
We have a little time left. So here is Jack Kerouac performing October in the Railroad Earth, accompanied by Steve Allen. This was recorded in about 1958.
There was a little alley in San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend, in red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work in offices. In the air you feel the impending rush of their commuter frenzy. As soon they'll be charging en masse from Market and Sansom buildings on foot and in buses and all well-dressed through working man Frisco of walk-up truck drivers. And even the poor grime-bemarked Third Street of lost bums, even Negroes so hopeless and long left east and meanings of responsibility and try that now all they do is stand there spitting in the broken glass, sometimes 50 in one afternoon against one wall at 3rd and Howard. Here's all these Milbrae and San Carlos neck-tied producers and commuters of America and steel civilization rushing by with San Francisco Chronicles and green called bulletins, not even enough time to be disdainful. They've got to catch 130, 132, 134, 136, all the way up to 146 till the time of evening supper in homes of the railroad earth, when high in the sky the magic stars ride above the following hot shot freight trains. It's all in California. It's all a sea. I swim out of it in afternoons of sun-hot meditation in my jeans with head on handkerchief on brakeman's lantern or, if not working, on book. I look up at blue sky of perfect lost purity and feel the warp of wood of old America beneath me. And I have insane conversations with Negroes in second-story windows above, and everything is pouring in. The switching moves of boxcars in that little alley, which is so much like the alleys of Lowell, and I hear far off in the sense of coming night that engine calling our mountains. But it was that beautiful cut of clouds I could always see above the little SP alley. Puffs floating by from Oakland, or the gate of Marion to the north, or San Jose south. The clarity of Cal to break your heart. It was the fantastic drowse and drum hum of lum mum afternoon, nothing to do. Old Frisco with end of land sadness. The people The alley full of trucks and cars of businesses nearabouts. Nobody knew or far from cared who I was all my life, 3,500 miles from birth, all opened up and at last belonged to me in great America. And now it's night in Third Street. The keen little neons and also yellow bulb lights of impossible-to-believe flops. The dark, ruined shadows moving back of torn yellow shades like a degenerate China with no money. The cat's in Annie's alley. The flop comes on, moans, rolls. The street is loaded with darkness. Blue sky above with stars hanging high over old hotel roofs and blowers of hotels mooning out dusts of interior. The grime inside the word in mouths falling out tooth by tooth. The reading rooms tick-tock big clock with creak chair and slant boards and old faces looking up over rimless spectacles bought in some West Virginia or Florida or Liverpool, England pawn shop long before I was born. And across rains they've come to the end of the land sadness, end of the world gladness. All your San Francisco will have to fall eventually and burn again. But I'm walking, and one night a bum fell into the hole of the construction job where they're tearing a sewer by day. The husky Pacific and electric youths in torn jeans who work there often, I think, are going up to some of them, like, say, blonde ones with wild hair and torn shirts, and they say, you ought to apply for the railroad. It's much easier work. You don't stand around the street all day, and you get much more pay. But this bum fell in the hole. You saw his foot stick out. British MG, also driven by some eccentric, once backed into that hole. And as I came home from a long Saturday afternoon local, the Hollister, out of San Jose, miles away across verdurous fields of prune and juice joy, there's this British MG backed and legs up, wheels up into a pit, and bums and cops standing right outside the coffee shop. It was the way they fenced it, but he never had the nerve to do it due to the fact that he had no money and nowhere to go, and oh, his father was dead, and oh, his mother was dead, and oh, his sister was dead, and oh, his whereabout was dead. But and then at that time also, I used to lay in my room on long Saturday afternoons listening to Jumpin' George with my fifth toque, no tea, and just under the sheets laugh to hear the crazy music. Mama, he treats your daughter mean. Mama, Papa, don't you come in here, I'll kill you, etc. Getting high by myself in room glooms, and all wondrous knowing about the Negro, the essential American, out there, always finding his solace, his meaning, in the fellaheen street, and not an abstract morality. And even when he has a church, you see the pastor out front bowing to the ladies on the make. You hear his great vibrant voice on the Sunday afternoon sidewalk, full of sexual vibrato, saying, why, yes, man, but the gospel do say that man was born of woman's womb. No, and so, by that time I come crawling out of my warm sack and hit the street, when I see the railroad ain't gonna call me till 5 a.m. Sunday morning, probably. For a local out of Bay Shore, in fact, always for a local out of Bay Shore. And I go to the whale bar of all the wild bars in the world, the one and only Third and Howard. And there I go in and drink with the madmen, and if I get drunk, I get. The girl who come up to me in there one night, I was there with Al Buckle, said to me, you want to play with me tonight, Jim? And I didn't think I had enough money.